Great. Thank you very much. Very pleased to see such a lively and large turnout for this afternoon's event. Let me first of all extend a warm welcome on behalf of CSIS to all of you. I'm Bates Gill. I hold the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's our great pleasure this afternoon to welcome Joseph Wu. Before we hear from Joseph, it's also my great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Flanagan, who will be making an introduction for Dr. Wu. We've been very, very fortunate to lure Stephen here from his former post at the Institute for National Security Studies at National Defense University, and he's now assumed leadership of the International Security Program here at CSIS. He's also a member of our senior management team as senior vice president at CSIS as well. I know he's familiar to many of, if not all of you, here in this room, and I'll turn the floor over to him to make an introduction. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bates, and welcome to all of you. On behalf of our president, Dr. John Hamray, who is off on a mission in Iraq, who sends his best wishes to Dr. Wu and to all of you as part of this independent commission to review the Iraq security forces, so he was unable to join us. But it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Joseph Wu here today as our speaker in his first major public event here at CSIS since assuming his position as representative of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office here in the United States in April of this year. Dr. Wu, as many of you know, has had a distinguished career in government and in the academic world. He has been most recently in his government positions chairman of the Mainland Affairs Council in the Executive Yuan. He was also served as Deputy Secretary General to the President in 2002-2004. Before that, he's had a long association with the National Chengchi University, which is his undergraduate alma mater. He was deputy director there of the Institute for International Relations, so he is a brother member of the think tank community. He's also been an adjunct professor there and an adjunct research fellow in the Election Studies Center. He's, as I mentioned, having completed his undergraduate work in Taipei, he went on then to receive his master's degree at the University of in the United States, his graduate education in the United States, particularly an MA in political science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and then on to Ohio State for his PhD in political science. He has specialized in areas of Taiwan political development, cross-strait relations, and also has a keen interest in Middle East politics. He is the author of a number of books, including on a book published by Oxford Press in 1995 on Taiwan's democratization and the forces behind that new momentum. He's also written a number of and edited a number of books on both the experience of divided countries and on China's rise and its implications. And it's on that topic, in a sense, this question of the balance of power in East Asia, the view from Taiwan, that he will be addressing us today, more of a broader geostrategic look at East Asia. And so we're delighted to welcome to this platform Dr. Joseph Wu.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Steve. And I'm delighted to come back to the CSIS again. It feels like I'm here every 2 weeks for a seminar or something else. But it is my true honor and true pleasure to be able to come back to the CSIS again and again. And if there's any additional need for me to be over here, to be interpolated by you, or to give you some of the stories from Taiwan, I'll be perfectly willing to do so. And for today's story, I would like to touch upon some of the things that we would usually discuss as the American interest on the global scale. And I'll try to put Taiwan in that picture of the American global interest to show how much Taiwan and the United States need to work together with each other. Usually when we try to come up with the American global interest, usually we do it in three different perspectives, and we can stretch on as far as we can, but usually they fall into these three categories. The first category, of course, is the security need of the United States to contain the spread of terrorism or to check with the unexpected rise of anything that might become a threat to the United States. And the United States also wanted to maintain its sole superpower status around the world. And if there's any threat against the homeland, that would also be one of the U.S. major concerns. So this is the first category of the U.S. interest. And the second category of the U.S. interest, I would stress that is a business interest or economic interest. The United States has been very keen in expanding its commercial interest to safeguard its global economic interest and to insist upon the market economy and fair trade. So this is another set of the U.S. interest. The United States, based upon its economic interests, are concerning about the free trade agreement with other countries, a concern about the free trade agreement within the Asia-Pacific, things like that. And this is something that we look at as one set of the U.S. core interests as well. And, of course, another set of the U.S. interests lies in the expansion of freedom and democracy. I still remember, and I'll continue to cite this, that in January 2005, I was here for President Bush's second inauguration. And even though it was very cold outside, but I think the crowd sitting in front of the Capitol Hill, just excited as I was, when we listened to President Bush's line that the best hope for peace lies in the expansion of freedom and democracy. And I think that is what we thought the interests of the United States by supporting democracies throughout the world and by expanding freedom and democracy to those countries that still do not enjoy freedom and democracy yet. And for this global picture, we can see that the U.S. interest in East Asia is exactly the same. It wants to prevent possible crisis from erupting into major conflict like in the Taiwan Strait area or in the Korean Peninsula. And I think the United States is also concerning about the bilateral agreements with individual countries like with Japan, with Australia, and with Korea, with New Zealand, and with Taiwan. And I think the United States is also concerned about the spread of weapons of mass destruction in the area, so it wants to expand the container security initiatives or other type of initiatives to safeguard the interests of the countries in the region. And I think the United States also wants to promote free market and fair trade with the countries in the region. And I think the United States is also interested in spreading and promoting freedom and democracy to those countries in East Asia that still do not enjoy those things yet. And if you look at the story of Taiwan, Taiwan totally fits into the U.S. global and regional interest. Taiwan happens to provide a security corridor for East Asia and the West Pacific. And Taiwan is also a loyal ally and an indispensable partner of the anti-terrorism for the United States over the years. And Taiwan fulfills almost all international obligations, even though it is not a member. It's either on the WHO terms or on other terms. And Taiwan is also a success story of free market. And Taiwan is the world's 16th largest trading power, but it is isolated from regional security. And Taiwan is a beacon of democracy for many countries in the region, especially for China. The Chinese government always say that the Chinese culture is different. But if Taiwan, which enjoys the same cultural heritage as China, and if Taiwan can become a democracy, I'm sure Taiwan can become a model for China to become a democracy in the future. And in addition, Taiwan is also completely a free country according to Freedom House survey. And Taiwan's democratic voices cannot be ignored. And by the same token, even though Taiwan is very small, but Taiwan is actually indispensable in many areas, especially in the area of market economy. If you look at Taiwan's economic performance, Taiwan is the largest trading partner of the United States, in which bilateral trade reaches $61.2 billion last year. And the U.S. investment in Taiwan is $14.1 billion. And Taiwan also had about $8.4 billion of investment in the United States. And Taiwan is the fifth largest exporting market for the United States agricultural product. And 95% of Taiwan's grain imports are from the United States. And the total value of Taiwan's OEM in computer chips amounts to $13.4 billion, or 68% of global market share in 2006. And I can go on and on and on about these statistics to show you Taiwan, even though it is very small, but Taiwan's economic status around the world is significant. Other than these economic sector or economic indicators, Taiwan is also very important in terms of the U.S. expansion of freedom and democracy. Taiwan, beginning from 1987, exactly 20 years ago, we started to mount the effort for democratization. And 20 years ago, almost today, we lifted the 38-year-old martial law. And after the martial law was lifted in 1987, Taiwan marched down the road of no return on democratization. In the 1991 and 1992, we had overall election for our parliament, including the National Assembly and the Legislative Yuan. And in July 1991, we also lifted and abolished the emergency decree of the Constitution. And in 1996, we had the first direct presidential election. And after the presidential election in 1996, many observers on Taiwan described Taiwan as a full-fledged democracy. And we are actually very proud of that. And I think there are many things China can learn from Taiwan's democracy, including liberalizing China's economy, or fostering autonomous middle class and civil society, or nationalizing the PLA, installing free and fair elections, creating independent judiciary, or respecting free speech and human rights. But if Taiwan falls into the Chinese hand, I'm sure you have many imaginations of what these that Taiwan can provide to China or other countries in the region will become. And I would further stress that even though Taiwan is prosperous economically, but Taiwan is also under threat. And that would put the United States in a situation where it has to look at the balance of power in East Asia. China's military modernization, as all of you have already understood, that has been in a tremendous path ahead. For example, the budget increase on the part of the PLA has been tremendous, and for this year alone, it's 17.8%. And other than the military budget, the Chinese is also mounting an overwhelming modernization effort in terms of its submarine capability, or in its air force capability, or even on its surface fleet capability. And all this seem to be geared at Taiwan. And it's not just the Chinese government that's been saying that they want to be ready for Taiwan. And I think the most recent Pentagon report concerning the PRC military is also pointing to the factor that the Chinese military modernization may be geared at Taiwan. And I think the short-range missiles alone is already more than 900 of them. And I think the Chinese side also has intermediate-range missiles or cruise missiles that can strike at Taiwan. And I think the Chinese fighter jet has also undergone a tremendous amount of modernization. Other than the J-10 they have rolled out recently, the Chinese also procured a large number of Su-30s and Su-27s, and they are already in service. And China is also preparing a symmetrical warfare against the United States so as to prevent the United States from intervening in the cross-strait conflict. This is being addressed by the most recent Pentagon report, and it's being addressed by the Chinese-owned military leaders as well. And the Chinese side also launched triple warfare. In other words, legal warfare, media warfare, and psychological warfare against Taiwan in order to alienate the U.S.-Taiwan interest. The Chinese threat on Taiwan expands to other dimensions of human security, and probably some of you have known this quite well already. For example, in the 2003 SARS, the Chinese has been working very hard to prevent the WHO from sending help to Taiwan. And the Chinese also refused to offer H5N1 samples, it's the bird flu samples, to Hong Kong and Taiwan researchers, and delayed its report of new cases to Taiwan. And just for your own, for your information, the Chinese relayed those informations to Taiwan, new cases of bird flu to Taiwan, only 2 hours before they make the public announcement of those bird cases, bird flu cases. So it's not being very helpful to us. China also expands chemical contaminated fish stocks and close to Taiwan, not just to the United States. And there's a tremendous amount of report in the United States, even though we try to report on that, but the report is not as significant as those reports carried in the U.S. media. And China also uses economic leverage to intervene Taiwan's free trade negotiations with other countries. And so far, we've been trying to negotiate with the United States, with Singapore, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand. But the free trade agreement negotiations with any country that do not have diplomatic ties with Taiwan is not going anywhere at all. And China also denied Taiwan's sovereignty status by robbing Taiwan diplomatic allies and by suppressing Taiwan's participation in international organizations, including the non-governmental organizations. And in the past year and a half also, the Chinese way of doing this against Taiwan is to change Taiwan's title of participation from Taiwan or the Republic of China into Taiwan China, Taipei China, or Taiwan Province of China, or Taiwan Province of the People's Republic of China. And I can give you a couple of more recent examples of how China was doing it. In the OIE, the Chinese side, OIE is a World Organization for Animal Health. The Chinese wanted to push forward for a resolution. And in this resolution, it wanted the OIE to recognize the One China principle that Taiwan is a part of the PRC. And it also wanted to identify Taiwan as a non-sovereign regional member. And it also wanted to change Taiwan's title of participation into Taiwan China. So all these kinds of things have been identified by the observers around the OIE. And finally, we got the United States to support Taiwan in this case. And even though we got stuck with a non-sovereign regional member, but Taiwan's membership at least can be attained. And Taiwan's status as not recognized by the One China principle is sustained. So these kinds of things shows how aggressive China has been in isolating Taiwan and or excluding Taiwan from international participation. And yet another very recent example is that UN Secretary General Mr. Ban Ki-moon, in a letter sent to Nauru representative to the United Nations, stating that the UN Resolution Number 2758 has already adopted a view that Taiwan is an inalienable part of the People's Republic of China. And I think if this one has gone through, then it would set a very bad precedent that China uses international organization to make Taiwan a really part of China, de jure part of China. So I would describe this as a de jure unification, even though it lacks the agreement of the Taiwan people. I think these kinds of scenario is just an indirect contradiction with the U.S. One China policy. And I would stress that China is trying to use the One China principle or to insert One China principle into the major international organizations or try to push through those letters or resolutions to make sure that the One China policy is truncated by the One China principle. And it is in the U.S. interest to restore the cross-strait status quo as unilaterally being changed by China. And under such kinds of circumstances, that the balance of power in East Asia have been subtly changed. What we would hope the United States would do for Taiwan or would do in this regard. First is to improve the mutual trust and coordination with Taiwan by having more high-level government consultations with each other. And we also hope that the United States can also enhance mutual economic interests with Taiwan to prevent Taiwan from economically being marginalized by China. And we hope that the United States can engage in FTA negotiations with Taiwan. And this is a particular interest to Taiwan people in light of the fact that there was a recent conclusion of the negotiations of FTA between South Korea and the United States. And as you know very well, Taiwan and South Korea are on exactly the same level of economic development. And therefore, an FTA in between the United States and South Korea is going to have a major negative impact on Taiwan's economy. And I think a negative impact on Taiwan's economy is probably going to put Taiwan in further jeopardy in its position vis-a-vis China, and it's probably not in the U.S. interest. And we also hope that the United States can promote freedom and democracy in East Asia by citing the success story of Taiwan. And we also hope that the United States can assist Taiwan to join or to participate in international organizations, including international governmental organizations or international non-governmental organizations. And we also hope that the United States can ensure full implementation of the U.S. commitment to Taiwan. And I think the security cooperation in between the United States and Taiwan to combat against terrorism is also very important for the United States to maintain a balance of power in East Asia. And I think it's also in the mutual interest of the United States and Taiwan. And we also hope that the United States can persuade Beijing to deal directly with Taiwan's duly elected leaders and their government. China, up until today, still refused to negotiate with Taiwan government on political issues or on other major bilateral issues in between Taiwan and mainland China. And I think the U.S. policy toward East Asia is that the two sides need to engage in peaceful negotiations with each other. But the Chinese government has not been very forthcoming on this issue. The final point I would say is that the United States can maintain the status quo of the Taiwan Strait by counterbalancing China's military threat toward Taiwan. And I think this is what we face in East Asia. And this is also what we think that would fall into the U.S. interest and also fall into Taiwan's interest. And I would be very willing to take on any of your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joseph, for those remarks and for laying out so clearly your views on the way in which Taiwan and its political and economic social development ought to fit into American strategy in East Asia broadly, as well as vis-a-vis China in particular. I don't know if you want to take questions standing or from the table, either one, whichever is more comfortable for you, having appeared in front of the press as often as you have. I know you can make that choice yourself. I wanted to ask one issue before we turn it over to the floor. I was hoping you would be able to characterize for us the current Washington-Taipei relationship. We know that in the past, recent past, there's been some difficulties. There remain a number of differences, a number of concerns on the Washington side as well as on the Taipei side, not only related to the issues you've just outlined, for example, whether it's the FTA or whether it's more support for Taiwan's international space, but also, as we know, coming into an election season in Taiwan, there are increased concerns as well on questions of the referenda that might be put forward, et cetera. Without getting into specifics on each and every one of those issues, I think we'd all like to get your sense of where you think the relationship stands, what are some of the key obstacles to improvement, and what do you see as your job to try and get through those obstacles? Please, why don't you? I think the media would appreciate that most of all.
Well, thank you very much for that question. That is a question that I encounter almost all the time after I came to the United States as Taiwan's chief representative here. The way I see it, after intense discussions with the staff in our office concerning the things that we are handling with the United States at this moment, I would describe that Taiwan's relations with the United States are very solid. And in economic area, even though we haven't been able to get an FTA negotiation started, but right at this moment, there's a TIFA talks in between Taiwan and the United States concerning three major issues. One is the government procurement. The second is avoidance of double taxation. And the third is bilateral investment agreement. And we have a hope that these three agreements will have very good chances to move ahead to make the economic relations between Taiwan and the United States even closer. And in other types of relations in between the United States and Taiwan. We have all kinds of educational exchange programs, and we have all kinds of cultural or non-governmental type of relations between Taiwan and the United States. And if you check around Taiwan's cabinet, I would probably say that Taiwan has the highest density of American PhDs in cabinets anywhere at all. And for that matter, I would say that many Taiwan high-level government officials think along the same way the Americans are thinking. So that would make the bilateral relations between Taiwan and the United States very close. And another area that I would describe that Taiwan's relations with the United States as very close is the security area. We have all kinds of talks in between Taiwan and the United States, you know, strategic level or operational level, and the exchanges in between the two sides concerning how to improve Taiwan's defense capability has been going on all the time. And that is something probably many of you have already known. But the two sides do have some differences with each other concerning political issues. I'm sure you remember in late 2003, it was a referendum issue right before Taiwan's presidential election. And over these years, sometimes there are issues popped up as surprises to the United States, and it will require very intense consultations in between the two sides. But before I came to the United States in April, I checked with some former representative to the United States, and they say that Taiwan's relations with the United States has never been perfect. And in the older days, there was intense negotiations concerning how the United States should treat Taiwan in a more formal manner, or the United States should maintain some security relations with Taiwan. Things like this has been problems before. But right now, we seem to be in a better position than before in those areas. But differences in political issues remains, and that will constantly require consultation in between the two sides. And I'll try to be more precise on some of the issues that we hope that there can be more consultations in between the two sides. One is, of course, the referendum issue. I think the administration is very concerned about the government's effort in having a referendum to decide on the name of Taiwan to enter the United Nations or to apply for the entry into the United Nations. And the State Department spokesperson has already come out to say that the U.S. opposes that kind of referendum. But what I'm concerned about is that Taiwan has its own domestic momentum, and the opposition of the United States concerning Taiwan's using a referendum to apply for the UN membership might become a momentum for the drive of the signatures. And on the other hand, you can see that the opposition in Taiwan, the KMT, is also initiating another referendum that is very similar to the DPP's referendum, because they understand that it's become an issue that the public in Taiwan has been supporting. So this is an issue that we hope that there can be more consultations with each other. And another issue that I will stress more precisely on the things we hope that there can be more consultation in between Taiwan and the United States is six assurances. President Ronald Reagan signed an August 17th communique with China in 1982. But prior to the signing of the communique, the United States sent a special envoy to Taiwan to address to the Taiwan president at the time, Mr. Jiang Jingguo, that the United States would assure this, this, and that to Taiwan, and that has become a backbone of the U.S. policies in dealing with Taiwan as well. But in the past few years, we saw that the United States doesn't seem to be reiterating the six assurances anymore. And therefore, it caused some concern on the part of Taiwan whether the U.S. has changed its position on the status of Taiwan's sovereignty. And I hope that this kind of thing would require the Taiwan government and the U.S. government for further consultations to make sure that Taiwan does not feel nervous. I think some of you have mentioned this before, that it is wrong for China to make Taiwan feel insecure. And I would say that it will be very important for the United States to reassure Taiwan that the United States is not abandoning Taiwan, or the United States is not changing its position concerning Taiwan's sovereignty status, because making Taiwan insecure from the U.S. end is going to make things even worse. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Why don't I just let you field some questions from the floor? We have 20 to 25 minutes or perhaps more, but let's see how things go. Why don't you go ahead,
Bunny?
And if our persons from the floor wouldn't mind just identifying themselves as well.
Thank you. Bonnie Glazer from CSIS. Is this on?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Joseph. Very much appreciated your remarks. My question goes to the issue of what you think the United States does not fully understand about Taiwan. I know even before you came here, before you were posted to Washington, you told reporters one of the things you really hoped to accomplish here was to help the United States, not just the U.S. government, but Americans understand better about Taiwan. So what is it that that Americans really don't fully understand about Taiwan? What would you like us to understand better?
Well, thank you very much. I think I have been trying very hard on the issue of Taiwan's situation. In the past couple of years, we see quite often that the United States has criticized Taiwan of making a situation, very often Taiwan suffers, especially the Taiwan government's reputation suffered because of that kind of criticism against Taiwan. But after I came over here, I almost always let the audience, whatever they say, audience, understand that Taiwan is really under a lot of pressure from China. And that is what I stress today as well. Even though Taiwan is prosperous, but Taiwan is under threat. And the threat came from two areas, military threat and diplomatic isolation attempts by the Chinese government. After I came over here, the first issue that I raised to the public over here and raised it to the administration officials is the implementation of the MOU signed in between the Chinese government and the WHO. And I didn't know whether there's a white audience who already know that, but at least when I present those kinds of documents in the American audience or to the administration officials, I got a feeling that that was new. And therefore, if I am able to provide more of these kinds of materials, the situation where what Taiwan is in to the American audience, and I think that would improve the American understanding of Taiwan's situation and the reason why Taiwan would do some certain things. Right before I came over here, the U.S. was quite critical of Taiwan's application of the membership of the WHO. The United States openly said that it's does not support Taiwan's participation or, you know, making an application to the WHO membership. But I don't know the U.S. attitude right now, but I'm sure the U.S. audience in the think tanks or in the administration understand that there's a Chinese deliberate effort in squeezing Taiwan out of international politics, including WHO or other international organizations. And I think the WHO attempt is very obvious, and I'm sure people in the United States understand that a whole lot better right now. I think, you know, on another issue like OIE, the World Organization for Animal Health, I didn't know what my predecessor was doing, but at least when I encounter these kinds of events, I become very forthcoming in letting the think tank or policy community in Washington, D.C. understand about this, or to let the administration officials understand about the situation that Taiwan's sovereignty is being put in danger by the Chinese tactics. And I think it's the same with the United Nations letter to Nauru. So this is the kind of thing I would let the American audience understand, that the Chinese government is undertaking a very hostile and very aggressive attitude in downgrading Taiwan's international participation. And I think this is what I thought I have accomplished over here. And even though we have not been able to roll back the Chinese aggressive behavior, but at least I can sense that the United States is very supportive on these kinds of issues concerning Taiwan's international participation. Right. Eric.
Eric McVeigh, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Joseph, right toward the end of your remarks, you used the term counterbalance, referring to the Chinese threat, that the U.S. and Taiwan should engage in that. I wonder if you'd embellish that a little bit. You mean to include, for example, convincing Beijing of the imprudence of its actions now and of an attack and so forth, or just military buildup or some combination of the two?
Well, the way I describe counterbalancing the Chinese deployment or Chinese threat, Chinese military threat toward Taiwan, is that the Chinese threat against Taiwan militarily has grown to such a degree that many of the policy community members in Washington, D.C., or even those in Japan are becoming very concerned. Many would even describe that China has more capabilities than they need in launching a military actions against Taiwan. You know, for the submarine alone, I don't know the exact number of the advanced submarines China has right now, including a Ming class, Song class, Yuan class, and 093, 094. Some of the military experts, I would say include yourself, would say that it takes only maybe a dozen of the Chinese submarines to blockade Taiwan. And in the past few months, the information I saw was there's so many Chinese submarine activities along the east coast of Taiwan that would indicate the Chinese aggressive behavior or the behaviors for China to prepare for some future contingencies against Taiwan. And I think these kinds of things will require the U.S. to think about more closely on things that will be necessary for Taiwan to be able to defend itself, or for the United States to be able to respond to emergency or spontaneous actions taken by China. And that is what I am thinking about. But I have to be very frank about the feeling I have right now concerning the U.S. and Japan cooperation. The three successive 3+2s seem to me is very important and very forthcoming, and I'm very glad that the United States and Japan are moving right along this area. And I'm also very glad that the United States seems to be redeploying along the East Asia. And I'm very glad that this kind of thing is developing. But concerning the rapid movement ahead on the Chinese military, I hope that the preparation on the U.S. side or the cooperation in between Taiwan and the United States can also be more forthcoming. And I would also hope that the United States would encourage Japan to have more security dialogues with Taiwan, because in the future, if there's going to be any conflict in between Taiwan and China, I'm sure there will be some actors, including Japan and the United States, that will be drawn into a situation, and a security dialogue in between Taiwan and Japan is only necessary. Professor Deng.
Zhong Jiandeng from National Change University. Dr. Wu, I have a question. I'd like to describe Taiwan as a kind of stakeholder, I mean, responsible stakeholder as the United States. So I would like to shift the topic to the economic side. As far as I know, that signing free trade agreement with the United States is on the highest priority in the Taiwanese government's agenda. And in your speech, you just mentioned about the free trade agreement. But also, we all know that the Trade Promotion Authority already expired on June 30th. So under this kind of circumstances, how do you proceed to promote this kind of a free trade agreement with the United States? Yeah. But also, in the end of your lecture, you mentioned something about bilateral investment agreement. Is this a kind of shift of strategy with regard to Taiwanese government to put emphasis upon signing bilateral investment agreement with the United States in lieu of FTA? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Deng. I know TPA has already expired on the 30th of June, and we don't know whether there's going to be a chance for the TPA to be renewed by the Congress. But what we would hope for is that once the TPA surfaced again, Taiwan is not left out in the process. And therefore, what I need to do, or what the Taiwan government needs to do over here in Washington, D.C., is to continue to address on the issue so that the audience in Washington, D.C. understand that there's an absolute need for Taiwan to have an FTA with the United States so that Taiwan's economy is not being made marginalized by the Chinese government's effort. And as long as there's a voice in Washington, D.C., that there's a need for Taiwan and the United States to have an FTA negotiation, and I'm sure the administration will think about this issue in a more serious manner. But I also understand the limitation on the part of the administration that is still consider an FTA negotiation in between Taiwan and the United States not the time for it yet. But if you look at those countries that are undergoing or has completed the negotiations with the United States concerning the FTA, Peru, Panama, Colombia, and South Korea, and if you compare Taiwan's market openness or labor standard or environment standard with all these countries, and I think Taiwan stands out to be much better than any of those countries. And I think if the United States is granting the free trade agreement with those countries, I'm sure the United States should consider Taiwan as more qualified for the FTA negotiation. Concerning the TIFA negotiations and with bilateral investment as part of it, and I think this is the U.S. policy, trade policy in dealing with Taiwan. At the same time, the U.S. government is telling Taiwan it's not time yet for an FTA, but at the same time, the United States wants to move ahead on some of those TIFA issues, bilateral TIFA issues, including government procurement or bilateral investment. And of course, any kind of improvement of trade relations between Taiwan and the United States is going to be in Taiwan's interest. And therefore, we would secure those opportunities to advance Taiwan's economic or trade relations with the United States. But at the same time, we do not give up the hope that Taiwan can have an FTA with the United States someday. There's a lot of talk about FTA, AP, in the air these few months after last year's APEC meeting. When we tried to check with the administration officials, what we got is that the administration officials doesn't seem to be quite ready for this grand strategy of FTA concerning all APEC countries. But The administration officials also wanted to continue to have conversations or preparations along this line. And since Taiwan is already a member of APEC, we hope that the FTA AP can become a reality, so that when this becomes a reality, Taiwan can become part of it as well. Thank you. Alan?
Alan Romberg at the Stimson Center. Thank you for your very clear and forceful statement. Doesn't seem to me you're going to have a lot of spare time when you're while you're here. At the end of your remarks, I think I'd have to say you implicitly criticized the United States when you said the U.S. should live up to its commitments. And I wondered if you could expand a bit on which commitments you're talking about and where the U.S. needs to do more work to live up to them.
Well, I think the U.S. has a security commitment. I think the U.S. also has a commitment on the democratization issue. I'm not criticizing the U.S. Policies in dealing with Taiwan in this forum, because I understand that having the U.S. supporting Taiwan is very important, and by criticizing the United States may not bring up the best result. But I think it is going to be... But I think it is going to be very important for Taiwan and the United States to work further in those areas that the United States has a long commitment to. For example, in the expansion of freedom and human rights and democracy. Taiwan can earn its democracy today because of the U.S. support. And I always have this TRA with me, and I always read this sentence, and I love it because that's because of the U.S. support that we have democracy today. Nothing contained in this act shall contravene the interests of the United States in human rights, especially with respect to human rights of all the approximately 18 million inhabitants of Taiwan. The preservation and enhancement of the human rights of all people on Taiwan are hereby reaffirmed as objectives of the United States. It is very important for us, and it is very important for us to keep reminding ourselves that the U.S. commitment to Taiwan's democracy, beginning from 1979, has brought about Taiwan's democracy. And when Taiwan has already become a democracy, I think that will further require the United States to safeguard this democracy. And what we see is that there's an encroachment of the Chinese effort in trying to demonize some of the processes in Taiwan that we deem as natural practices of democracy. For example, in other countries, in East Europe or in the other parts of the world, they are using referendum to decide upon the future of those countries. And that has been supported by the United States. And, to me, the U.S. continue to stress upon the will of the Taiwan people, or the agreement of the Taiwan people, or the assent of the Taiwan people in the resolution in between Taiwan and mainland China. So eventually, a democratic process like those of referendum is going to be the key to resolve the dispute in between Taiwan and mainland China. So I hope that these kinds of commitment to Taiwan's democracy, or to commit, these kinds of commitment to Taiwan's democratic way of handling things, should also be observed, or should also be more respected by the United States. So that is what I'm talking about. And Taiwan is already a democracy, and I think the lessons that we learn from democracy, that democracy or democratization means uncertainty. We don't have those old authoritarian leaders. We don't have those dictators telling Taiwan that this is the only way to go anymore. And therefore, we have different kinds of arguments in Taiwan, and they are competing for the audiences in Taiwan. And therefore, we have uncertainty. And I think if the United States has some little difficulties in dealing with Taiwan democracy, and I also feel that the United States also had a little bit difficulties in dealing with the South Korean government. And I think we need to understand more that democracy really means uncertainty, and we probably need to come up with a better strategy in dealing with democracies that are under threat. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for giving me the chance to ask questions. I'm from China's Xinhua News Agency.
Right.
Obviously, tough questions. Sorry. First, You just talk about, I think most observers will agree that if there is no change in the status quo, there will be peace. But you just now you talk about Taiwan is nervous about. Why Taiwan is nervous about for the moment? Second question is, the Washington Post published a very interesting interview with Mr. Chen Shui-bian yesterday. And in the interview, Mr. Chen Shui-bian asked a lot of questions, say, in any case, he can't understand on what grounds the Bush administration voiced objections against the referendum. Is it about the matter of holding a referendum itself, or about joining the UN, or about using the name Taiwan? What is there to oppose the end of this? And you are the representative here, and what's your answer? Why? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much for this very important question, especially bringing up the article reported by Washington Post. You know, I would welcome anyone from China to be present when I make a speech or, you know, do any press conference. And I think that kind of question is very important, not just for us to understand the Chinese concern, but also very important to explain the things on the part of Taiwan so that you can understand. And I also hope that maybe anyone from the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C. can come and participate in forum like this so there can be more two-way exchanges so that, you know, there'll be more understanding on the part of China about the situation Taiwan is in and or on some of the things or motivation on some of the things on the part of Taiwan. You mentioned about status quo. And actually, status quo, if you look further on the situation beginning from 1949, the two sides of the Taiwan Strait do not have any relations with each other anymore. The nationalist government retreated to Taiwan. And on the Taiwan part, there's a Republic of China government. And on the mainland, there's a People's Republic of China government. And on the Taiwan side, we have a president and we have a parliament. And I think these two are very high symbols of sovereignty. And on the Taiwan part, the government also exercises exclusive jurisdiction over the territory under its control. And I think that's another symbol of sovereignty. And beginning from 1991 and 1992, the parliament in Taiwan has become democratically elected. And beginning from 1996, the presidency has also become publicly elected and democratically elected. So on the Taiwan side, the sovereignty or the independence of Taiwan or the de facto independence of Taiwan has been strengthened. And I think this is the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. And, you know, what Taiwan has been trying to do is that we want to safeguard this fact that Taiwan and China is separated, but we do not rule out any future possibilities of forming relations with China. But since Taiwan is a democracy, and I will stress this further, since Taiwan is a democracy, any kind of agreement between Taiwan and mainland China needs to have the assent of the Taiwan people or needs to go through a democratic process. And I think that's the proper way in dealing with the cross-strait disputes. And about the article you mentioned, why with the United States opposed referendum, and I think I answered that when I answered Alan's question a little bit earlier. And I think the second part of your question concerning President Chen's statement, why would the United States oppose Taiwan? It is very important because Taiwan is being put in a very precarious situation by China. You know, Taiwan's name is Taiwan, and our official title is the Republic of China. But when we try to use the Republic of China, it's going to be very difficult. I cannot even use Republic of China in the United States. You know, the State Department here has a list of do's and don'ts. And calling Taiwan the Republic of China is one of those don'ts. Never call Taiwan as Republic of China. Never call Taiwan authority as government officials. Never call Taiwan president as Taiwan president should call, you know, Taiwan authorities. Things like this. So Taiwan cannot call itself as the Republic of China. But at the same time, Taiwan's most natural name is Taiwan, just like my name is Joseph Wu. That's what everybody calls me. So when we try to apply for international participation, and when we cannot use the Republic of China as being opposed to by China, then the only way for Taiwan to go is Taiwan. But I think the way the Chinese government is working on this is really different, because it does not allow Taiwan to use the name Taiwan. You know, it wants to impose on Taiwan some of the things that we do not deserve. For example, the Chinese Taipei, we don't like it. It's not our name. And Taiwan, China, we hate it even further. And Taiwan, the province of China, people get crazy in Taiwan. So these kinds of things should be considered by the Chinese authorities as some hostile actions against the Taiwan people that would make the Taiwan people very angry. I got some of the things that you would find very interesting, why Taiwan should use the name Taiwan. In one of the I need to find the place of it. Anyway, the State Department guideline in calling Taiwan, the proper noun and adjective to the people, to the island, and to the entity is Taiwan. So if the U.S. policy in dealing with Taiwan is to call Taiwan Taiwan, why cannot ourselves call ourselves Taiwan? And I think that's the question. Thank you. I'm sorry, I keep raising your hand.
Charles Freeman from the China Alliance of Independent Law Firms. Just a quick question. You raised earlier the notion that the Bush administration has continuously been criticizing rather publicly the statements coming out of Taiwan. And it occurs to me that 7-8 years ago that the administration probably wouldn't have been so quick to do that, given that concerns about what the reaction would have been on Capitol Hill. There was a lot of trepidation back then about what Congress would have said if the administration were so public in its criticism about Taiwan. And can you describe, what do you attribute the sudden courage, if for lack of a better word, of the administration to be so bold in criticizing Taiwan so publicly?
Well, I think the first issue must be dealing with the procurement issue. The Bush administration went its way to promise Taiwan three major packages of arms and hoping that Taiwan would procure those items so that Taiwan can better defend itself. But we just dragged on and on and on those issues, and I think it has some negative impact on the mutual trust in between Taiwan and the United States. And I think that kind of issue has also led some of the members on Capitol Hill to question Taiwan's determination to defend itself. And therefore, in the last few years, this issue has taken a toll on Taiwan's relations with the United States. And I need to stress at this point that on June 15th, the national budget, the government budget, has been approved by our parliament, and included in that government budget or part of the procurement package that was promised by the Bush administration in 2001, including the 12 P-3C airplanes and the upgrade of the PAC-2 Plus, as well as some of the assessment fee for the submarine to be built by the United States. So we hope that these kinds of improvement, gradual, slow, but sure improvement in Taiwan's commitment, or Taiwan living up to its commitment for self-defense, will gradually improve the situations in between Taiwan and the United States. But I also need to stress that China has been rising economically and politically, as well as diplomatically. And China has been using its newly rising power to engage in lobbying effort on the Capitol Hill. And I think with Taiwan's ability at this moment, I have to be very frank that it's going to be very hard for Taiwan to compete against. You know, China has the manpower and China has the resources to engage in those kinds of activities Taiwan used to say that we have been quite successful in. But since China is engaging more than Taiwan do, and China present to a lot of people here in the United States as a very attractive market or source of business opportunities, and I'm sure China is going to advance quicker than Taiwan when the two sides are engaging in the same type of activities. But there's only one thing that Taiwan has advantage at this moment, that is Taiwan is a democracy and China is not. And Taiwan trying to live up to the rules set up by the modern civilization, and China still seems to have some problems. But in the long run, I think the best solution to all these kinds of conflict or these kinds of debate in between Taiwan and the United States or in between Taiwan and China is that the two sides of the Taiwan Strait need to sit down and try to work something out with each other. And no matter what kind of solution that is, it has to go through a democratic process in Taiwan. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. Mm-hmm. How do you put into perspective Taiwan's very large trade and investment with China today, and the large number of people from Taiwan who live on China? Does the government continue to support this, or is it looking to diversify Taiwan's trade and investment elsewhere in Southeast Asia?
Well, thank you, Tom. Indeed, Taiwan's economic relations with China is very intense, despite the fact that the diplomatic relations, political relations, or military relations between Taiwan and mainland China are terrible. And I think they are like two parallels. They don't cross each other. You know, we try to increase the cultural exchanges, economic exchanges between the two sides in the hope that the political relations in between Taiwan and China would improve. But they haven't improved. And we were quite sad about that. And if you look at some of the statistics of economic relations between Taiwan and China, for example, China has become almost the most important trading partners of Taiwan. And we enjoy a trade surplus for about $40 billion annually in the past 3 years or so. And the amount of Taiwan's investment in mainland China has exceeded $150 billion. And for last year and the year before, investment in mainland China represent about 70 or more percent of Taiwan's total outbound investment. And for those figures, the economic planners in Taiwan worry that if we put all eggs in one basket, and when one day this basket has some problems, Taiwan is going to suffer. And therefore, there's always a deliberate policy in Taiwan to encourage businessmen to find business opportunities in other places, and we will continue to do that. But since Taiwan is already a democracy, there's impossibility for the Taiwan government to tell the businessmen that, you cannot go to China. You have to go to Southeast Asia, you have to go to Brazil, you have to go to India, things like that. So we try to provide market information to the Taiwan businessmen so that they can make a smart choice on their own. But so far, China still represents an attractive place for the Taiwan businessmen, and therefore the Taiwan businessmen just continue to go to China for their business opportunities. And there's a philosophy in Taiwan nowadays, and I think that is in line with those political scientists who has been arguing that if a country that is undergoing more rapid economic modernization or social transformation, the society is probably going to change, and there's probably going to be new demand for example, for freedom or democracy. And that's probably what we can hope for in China in the long run. And we do see indicators in China that there may be more and more people who want to rise up for more freedom and democracy. And I always cite one example, the freezing point, Bingdian. There was a magazine issued in northern China. In fact, it was being circulated in whole China. And that was forced to stop last January. But many of the intellectuals in China, including the writers and editors and many of the senior statesmen, just petitioned to the propaganda department in China. That finally led to the Chinese government to allow that magazine to republish. And that seems to me is a very encouraging sign that many people in China nowadays, they want to drive for more freedom and democracy. And if that kind of trend can continue, I'm sure Taiwan's investment policy toward China or Taiwan's economic relations with China is going to bear its positive fruit in the long run. Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Wu. DeWardrick McNeil from the Brookings Institution. In your remarks, you spoke about the increasing pressure that Taiwan is feeling from diplomatic isolation. And I'm wondering if you could say something about the loss of Costa Rica. Did you see the writings on the wall there? Was there terms that perhaps they requested that Taiwan wasn't able to meet? And should we see this as some sort of a slide in Latin America in terms of Taiwanese relationships in Latin America? Is there some sort of strategy that you have in place to combat China's increasing global diplomatic initiatives?
Well, thank you very much for this question. It is indeed one factor the Taiwan government concerns a lot. We have 24 countries recognizing Taiwan in the world nowadays. And by any country that sever its diplomatic ties with Taiwan and switch their recognition to China, it's going to have serious impact on the psychology of the Taiwan people. That is going to make the Taiwan people feel more and more desperate. In the past, we saw some of these derecognition of Taiwan and switch of the diplomatic recognition to China has caused tremendous degree of problems in between Taiwan and China. And I have to be very frank that the Chinese government, especially MOFA, has resources at its disposal to manipulate these kinds of things. I still remember in the 2002 case of a diplomatic switch, the Chinese government promised $137 million for a tiny little country that has a population only 10,700. And in 2005, when the Grenada switch is diplomatic relations to China, the Chinese government, according to our information, promised $250 million. And in the case of Senegal, in October 2005, the Chinese government promised $600 million. You know, that's the information provided to me by some of the security agencies in Taiwan. So, you know, Taiwan does not have these kinds of resources. And especially with the fact that Taiwan is already a democracy, the media in Taiwan, the parliament in Taiwan would not allow these kinds of things to happen in Taiwan. In other words, the people in Taiwan would not allow MOFA in Taiwan to engage in excessive amount of aid to any country in order to retain that kind of a diplomatic relations. And if the Chinese government has resources and if the Chinese government has that kind of will, it will continue to advance in this regard. But I think if the Chinese government continue to do these kinds of things, the only impact that I will foresee is that the cross-strait relations is going to be in danger, that the cross-strait situation is going to suffer because of this. And I'm sure we are all going to pay for that because of these kinds of recognition activities. And on the Taiwan part, even though we have not been, we have not been willing to engage these kinds of money diplomacy vis-a-vis China, and we're probably not able to compete against China. But what we try to do is to live up to our commitment to those countries on humanitarian aid or on the aid packages that would really help those countries to develop in a better way. So that is what we want to do. And we hope that the Chinese government will think in a very clear way on what it will do to China's interests or what it will do to advance China's interest if it continue to snatch diplomatic allies away from Taiwan. Right. Can I make it the last question because I need to run to another place?
Parameswaran from Agence France Presse. You had mentioned earlier that you wanted to have greater discussions with the United States in relation to the question of referendum and seeking their understanding, etc. How confident are you that the United States will change its mind when it is becoming more dependent on China, on it has got bigger fish to fry? For example, North Korea, it's depending on China. Then you have Sudan. Then you have now even Burma, where they have got China is mediating. So how do you expect the U.S. to change its mind, and how confident are you?
Well, I think there are two levels concerning your excellent question. The first level is on the issue of referendum. If we flash back to 2003 and 2004, that was a difficult issue at the time, and I'm sure the issue is just as difficult at this moment, and I don't have to, try to smooth things and say that it's not a problem. It is indeed a problem, or it's an issue that will require intense consultation in between Taiwan and the United States. But if you look at another level of the situation in between the United States and China, indeed, the United States would need the Chinese cooperation on the six-party talks, on Iraqi situation, on Iranian nuclearization issue, on Darfur issue, things like this. But as my conversation with some of the U.S. government officials went, there's also some awakening of the, at least some of the officials from the Bush administration. They started to realize that maybe the Chinese government is not as helpful as they need to be. For example, Darfur issue, there's a sense of frustration on the part of some administration officials that China has not been very helpful. And when the United States mentioned about using the UN sanctions as a tool to force Bashir regime to change its policy in Darfur regime, the Chinese diplomats were very quick to come out and criticize the U.S. policy. So this kind of thing is making U.S. administration officials, at least some U.S. administration officials, rather frustrated. And I think even though the U.S. policy in getting the Chinese cooperation is quite obvious nowadays, but I think there's also a part of the U.S. administration who are considering China as one country that is also giving the U.S. some headaches. If you look at the problems around the world today, as I mentioned, the six-party talks, the Iraqi situation, Iranian situation, or Darfur, and if you look further to other countries that are considered to be trouble spots for the United States, Zimbabwe, Angola, Venezuela, and who is the country? Which is the country that is supporting all these forces that is making the United States feeling headache? It is China. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joseph. We greatly appreciate, Joseph, your excellent remarks. We welcome you back to CSIS another time. Thanks to Steve and to you, and we're adjourned. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.